You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
This summer, I went on a boat trip on the River Thames. I was in London as a tourist for a couple of days, and it seemed like a relaxing way to get a sense of the city. The tour left from Westminster and headed downstream towards the old docks of East London. At first, there were lots of historic buildings for the guide to point out. But after a while, there was nothing more to look at than tower after tower of luxury apartments lining both banks of the river. Cher lives in this one, he said. Rowan Atkinson lives in that one. It was all, as the tour guide said dryly, unaffordable housing. London is one of a number of places around the world that has seen its run-down inner-city neighborhoods torn down to build apartments for the fantastically rich. David Madden is an assistant professor in the sociology department and the cities program at the London School of Economics. In a recent article published in the Guardian newspaper, he argues that gentrification is not synonymous with urban renewal. David Madden joins me on the phone today from London. Hello, David.
Hi.
Now, in your article, you identify several myths about gentrification. The first is that we're faced with a choice between urban decay and the luxury high-rise towers that I was describing in my introduction. What's missing from that either-or picture?
Yeah, well, there's this very strong narrative of neighborhood improvement. I mean, if you talk to urban planners or local developers or just reading the newspaper or websites, you see very strongly there's this sort of sense that what is good for a neighborhood is luxury housing, and that a successful neighborhood is a neighborhood where you have rich people. And the idea is that working class or poor people sort of need to be moved elsewhere. And there's also this sort of very strong narrative that there's this sort of bad old days of poverty in cities, and this sort of bright gentrified future is what we need to move towards. I think this is a real problem because it ignores the fact that there is a different way, a way that doesn't maintain the status quo, but which democratizes the city and which redistributes neighborhood resources so that everyone benefits rather than just a few.
Now, very often people say that when an area gentrifies, then everyone in the city benefits. And this is a theory that you characterize as the trickle-down argument for gentrification. What actually happens when the very wealthy move into the center of a city?
Yeah, well, and to be sure, we're not just talking about the very wealthy moving into the center of the city. This is something that's happening in so many different neighborhoods in many different parts of so many cities. It takes different forms in different places, of course, but the sort of single characteristic that links anything that we might want to call gentrification is that it is the production of urban space to serve the interests of the powerful. And I think it's important to sort of keep that in mind. These are neighborhoods that are changing in order to help the powerful and the economic elite. And so there's this sort of idea that people sometimes have that when neighborhoods change in this way, it helps everyone, and you know, they look at a neighborhood that maybe 20 years ago had been experiencing real economic distress, and now they see luxury housing and new shops, and it sort of makes people think that this is social progress, but in reality, poor people and working class people and middle class people are just being shifted elsewhere. So there's this broad shift within urban regions of where the poor are living. But for the most part, in the vast majority of cases, we're not seeing poor people becoming wealthy. We're just seeing people shifted out of their neighborhoods, long time community and social bonds being broken, and people being forced to just continually move.
It's a pretty prevalent myth, though, that when people look at an inner city area, and we're in our radio station here, we were located in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and I know you actually know Vancouver, so you know the area in which we're located, and people kind of from the outside without an understanding of the issues say, well, it's looking better.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that this sort of equation of gentrification with improvement, it's just a very sort of partial perspective on things. And I mean, part of my point is that the dominant conversation about gentrification doesn't really do justice to the issues. So it either sort of promotes gentrification, claiming that it helps everyone when it doesn't, or it naturalizes gentrification, saying that it is inevitable and the outcome of supposedly organic forces, which it's not. Or people do criticize gentrification, but they do so in ways that sort of reproduce this middle-class perspective on it, which ignores a lot. So, I mean, my sort of point is that gentrification is all about inequality. And so when you talk about it as a sort of stylistic issue, as about something concerning, you know, whether neighborhoods are becoming uncool or inauthentic, you know, you really sort of miss the point. So, the image we should have of gentrification is the image of working class and poor families being evicted from their housing. The predominant image that we tend to have about gentrification is of cupcake shops opening. And I'm saying when you focus on the cupcake shops and ignore the issues about inequality, you really get a sort of confused picture of what gentrification is all about.
So you're talking about when middle class people move into a neighborhood that was kind of gritty and cool, then the later part of that process is it becomes ungritty and uncool.
Well, and it's also that grittiness and coolness are really beside the point, I think. And that, I mean, sure, you know, we can sort of inquire into what the experience of neighborhood change is for middle-class people, but we're not hearing the voices of the less wealthy and less powerful people who are really being impacted by this process much more strongly and in much more devastating ways than our middle-class people.
Now, very often, private developers are asked to provide social housing units as a kind of payment, in a way, for being allowed to build on inner-city land. Is that a workable solution?
Well, I mean, there are a million different ways in which this can work out, and some ways are better and some ways are worse. But I think there is the sort of risk that affordable housing that is built as part of inclusionary zoning programs, or that's sort of the, maybe in some ways you could think of it as the sort of tax that developers pay in order to have the right to build luxury housing, this risks sort of minimizing and sidelining social housing as a sort of housing form. I mean, they often, developers will build things that sort of qualify legally as affordable housing but really aren't affordable to most people. They will, in some cities, developers can build affordable housing off-site, miles away, and not do a very good job of it. And I don't think that it's really a sort of solution to our unequal and undemocratic cities to have developers throw in a sort of token of supposedly affordable housing, and then go on and build thousands and thousands of very expensive housing units.
Now, I grew up in England, and I know that the increase in equality in England has been really kind of astronomical, and certainly in Canada, there's a growth in inequality. How does that fit into the picture?
Well, that really is the picture, and I mean, I think when we are talking about gentrification, it's part of this larger phenomenon of growing inequality. And we need to sort of focus on this. And I mean, this is an era where we see elites coming to dominate in so many different sectors of social life, and gentrification is sort of one phenomenon or one example of how elites are coming to dominate urbanism.
Now, as I was just saying, that talking about our area here in the downtown East Side, there has been a fight going on for a long time, but to fight against gentrification. But at this point, it's starting to feel like it's an unstoppable force here, and you identify that in your article, that it can feel like that, but it is possible to turn back the tide. What is needed to do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, people sort of misunderstand gentrification and think that it is sort of natural, or think that it is inevitable. They don't realize that it's often rooted in policy choices that local governments and planners make. So, I mean, sort of one way to sort of counteract gentrification would be for local governments to stop enacting policies that promote it. Also, I mean, you know, when people see gentrification as sort of this problem about, you know, cupcakes and uncool neighborhoods, you know, they miss the sort of political economic aspects to it, and they don't realize there are tons of policies that can counteract gentrification. Building truly affordable social housing, expanding public housing, strengthening labor unions, strengthening local social movements. There's just so many ways to make a more democratic and more egalitarian city, and that's what we really need to think about. I mean, that would be the alternative to gentrification. So we need to sort of ask ourselves, given any neighborhood that where, you know, where there's some sort of argument about gentrification, how could we make this more egalitarian? I think that's really what we should ask.
So it's not a lack of strategies; it's a problem. It's a lack of will, then.
Yeah, it's partly a lack of will. It's partly that a lot of people really profit from gentrification, and those are loud, powerful voices, and you know, they're not interested in promoting alternative plans. And so, oftentimes, when there's a big fight about development, you know, developers who have big platforms for getting out their message will say, you know, look, we have to go forward with this project, or this neighborhood will be, you know, mired in decay, and they sort of dismiss all alternative plans that are offered as impractical, you know, when that's usually not the case.
Are there cities that you could point to, either now or in the past, where this kind of approach has worked, where there's been a desire to make the city more democratic, more egalitarian, and that has worked?
Well, there are a lot of sort of smaller scale examples of what I'm talking about, with the sort of democratization of the city, even in the present day. So something like participatory budgeting, which is becoming increasingly popular in cities around the world, is an example of this. So this is where groups of citizens get together and, using direct democracy tactics, sort of decide how to spend public funds and decide how to set public priorities. And this is often, you know, at a small scale, and the idea would be to shape cities on a larger scale. But, you know, there are things even today that that are sort of examples of more democratic kinds of urban practice. But if you sort of historicize the issue a bit and think about the history of cities, you see that this period where we're living now, where elites are really dominating urban policies, and where this sort of gentrification narrative is really dominating the urban imagination, this era is really just one era, and it is a very sort of specific one that that emerged and then could change again. I mean, one of the things I say in the Guardian piece is that there was a time when you had cities like New York and London and countless others building public housing, building public space, public health systems, educational infrastructures, really making a city for everyone and not just for an elite. So this is in the earlier and mid 20th century. And obviously there were a lot of complexities to this period, a lot of conflicts. Not everything that all these cities did was desirable. And I'm not suggesting that we need to somehow sort of return to the era of modernism. But I am saying that the fact that, you know, you walk around London, you can see everywhere these sort of examples of a much more egalitarian kind of urbanism with council housing And, you know, similarly in New York and countless other cities, just the fact that they're there should tell us that other urbanisms are possible.
Well, it's been great talking to you today, David, and I'm going to refer people to your excellent piece in The Guardian.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with David Madden. He's an assistant professor in the Sociology Department and the Cities Program at the London School of Economics. His recent article on gentrification can be found in The Guardian. The title is, "Gentrification Doesn't Trickle Down to Help Everyone."